Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What sort of man is Bill Clinton, and how did his strengths, weaknesses, values, and life experiences play into the way he ran the country for 8 years? Even before he set out to interview more than 150 people who have known the former president over the course of his lifetime, independent scholar and oral historian Michael Takeoff understood that the subject of his research inspired both passionate admiration and ferocious disdain. And those distinctions are not always tied directly to people's political leanings. The volume that comprises Takeoff's interviews is unlikely to settle the arguments about who Bill Clinton is and what he stands for, but it does offer a wide-ranging yet intimate glimpse into the life of one of America's most polarizing political figures. The new book is called A Complicated Man, The Life of Bill Clinton as Told by Those Who Know Him. Michael Takeoff, welcome to Think.
Thank you so much for having me.
So you spoke to people who both love and hate Bill Clinton. What assurance did you have that people of either persuasion would be entirely candid with you?
Well, Bill Clinton inspires, really, as you said, passionate emotions among people. And when you're listening to people talk about him, they really didn't hold back. Many of them, some of them, were really quite fervent in both their praise, or in either their praise or their condemnation of the man. And that was part of the sort of fun of the project, and that was what made it so intriguing. I heard from so many different people in so many facets of his life, and the process was crystallized. One day I went to see Dick Armey in the morning, the very conservative former House Republican majority leader, and then after lunch met with Terry McAuliffe, the Democratic fundraiser extraordinaire and premier friend of Bill. Now, Dick Armey has contempt for Bill Clinton. He calls him the most accomplished adolescent I've ever seen. Terry McAuliffe loves Bill Clinton. He says, what a guy. He says, this guy gets out of bed every morning to give the average Joe a shot at the American dream. And I walked out of McAuliffe's office wondering, were we talking about the same person? And, of course, the answer is we were, because in a way they're both right. Bill Clinton can be childish and self-indulgent. He acts in ways a middle-class man you would think would have left behind many years before. He can be a cad and a liar, but he also can be astonishing and admirable and delightful. And that's really that was the fun for me of putting together this book.
I was struck by the fact that he seems to very genuinely feel the pain of strangers who have suffered. There's an amazing photograph you include in the book of him giving this fatherly kiss on the head to a little girl left homeless by the conflict in Kosovo. It's almost impossible looking at that to doubt that he cares in that moment. On the other hand, he seems unbelievably dense at times about how his own actions hurt the people he's closest to.
Exactly. That's sort of the conundrum and the paradox of Bill Clinton. There's a wonderful story which kind of draws on both aspects of it. During the summer of 1991, there was a conundrum he faced. He was a governor of Arkansas. Now, the previous year, in a televised candidate's debate leading up to his reelection, he told the citizens of Arkansas that if he were reelected, he'd serve out his entire term. Well, of course, everyone knew that was not going to happen. So the following summer, he went on this so-called permission tour. He traveled around Arkansas asking people to release him from his promise. Well, guess what? They all said he could run for president. So he was on a leg of this ridiculous, shameless tour, and he's getting ready to leave one event and go back to the airport to fly to another. And then there's this young kid who's standing alongside, and he wants to speak to the governor. So Bill Clinton goes up and he talks to him. And then he walks away from the crowd, from the security people, from the press. He puts his arm around this kid, just an ordinary kid, and he talks to him for several minutes. And then he comes back. It turns out that the kid was having troubles in his life. He was thinking of dropping out of school, and Bill Clinton was giving him some advice. And as he was telling the story, tears were rolling down his face. And he said, now you can see why I don't want to leave this job. Hmm. And this is at the same time that he's on this preposterous political stunt.
Do you get the sense that he himself is a self-aware person? You did not speak to him for purposes of this book, is that correct?
I didn't. He doesn't speak to biographers.
Right. Do you sense he knows himself very well?
I think he knows. He does know himself. I think there are aspects of his personality about which he's in denial. I guess that could be true of all of us, but I think one thing he's certainly in denial about is the effect of the Lewinsky scandal on the outcome of the 2000 election. Remember how close that election was and all the different factors that went into George Bush taking the White House, including the candidacy of Ralph Nader, the questionable ballots in places in Florida, the decision of the Supreme Court, the awkwardness of Al Gore as a campaigner, of course. But really front and center was the Lewinsky scandal. Michael Dukakis, the former Massachusetts governor, speaks in the book, and he says right out, without Lewinsky, Gore would have won by 15 points. Peace and prosperity, there wasn't really much else to talk about. The moral turpitude of the Clinton White House was really George Bush's strongest point in his campaign. And Bill Clinton has never really come clean about that. I don't think he's ever admitted it to anyone else. I doubt if he's admitted it to himself.
Let's go back to his childhood in Arkansas. For the most part, people who knew him as a kid seemed to remember him with great tenderness.
Oh, he was a remarkable a child. You know, one of the great things about this book is I spoke to so many people from all aspects of his life. There's the cousin who took him to the Saturday Westerns in Hope, Arkansas. There's another cousin who remembers seeing him in the high chair, and his grandmother. His grandmother was taking care of him, of course, because his mother was in New Orleans studying nursing. His grandmother would say, "Eat, Billy, eat." And there's a great scene from a kindergarten classmate. They went to this school called Miss Mary Perkins School for Little Children, and it was a private kindergarten in Hope, Arkansas. There was no public kindergarten, so all the kids went there. And he said that when there were disagreements, when there were fights on the playground, Bill Clinton would be the peacemaker when he was 5 years old. And, of course, carry that forward to Northern Ireland, to the Middle East. It's quite a remarkable insight from this man.
Yeah, it's funny to think about that quality of his leadership showing up so very early.
Yes, it is. And also his amazing facility with people. Another classmate of his remembers meeting him in fourth grade. Bill Clinton was starting a new school. It was called the Ramble School in Hot Springs. And at 8, 9 years old, here comes this kid, and he sticks out his hand and says, "Hi, I'm Bill Clinton." And really, fourth graders don't act like that, but Bill Clinton did.
Now, we know his father, his biological father, died before he was born.
Yes.
His mother and his stepfather had a troubled relationship. Was he a peacemaker within the family?
Well, you know, there's the famous story he told about standing up to his stepfather.
Yeah.
His stepfather, not always, but could be violent towards his mother, towards Virginia. And, of course, the famous confrontation we all heard about in 1992 when Bill Clinton was running for president, when he grabbed a golf club, actually, and told his stepfather, "Don't you ever touch my mother like that again." So he was standing up to his stepfather. There's something really interesting, though, about what we know about Bill Clinton's family. And I think this is a misconception we have, or it's something that I learned, certainly, and that there was another side to Bill Clinton's stepfather, to Roger. There's a great story told by Bill Clinton's next-door neighbor. Her name is Carolyn Staley. She was his next-door neighbor in Hot Springs, and she's one of the premier top friends of Bill throughout the country. Of course, there are thousands and thousands. She's one of the most important. She was working at Clinton Motors. It was the Clinton auto dealership owned in Hot Springs by actually the brother of Clinton's stepfather, and Clinton's stepfather was working there, too. And she was working in the parts department. She had a summer job. And Roger Clinton said to her, "Carolyn, go out and look at that car that just came in." A car had just come in. It had been involved in a fatality. Someone had died driving this car. He said, "Go look at that car." And she went and looked, and she looked at the steering wheel, at the dashboard. She saw blood on the dashboard and even bits of flesh. And the way she saw it is that Roger Clinton was saying to her, in a very loving way, was saying, "Be careful. Accidents happen. Be safe." It was it's a very moving story. And you also talk to all the people who were around the Clintons at that time, even some of the cousins and the relatives, and they never saw the bad side of Roger Clinton. They remember him very fondly as a sort of a funny, happy guy, a very friendly guy. So there was another side to him. And another point, which is interesting, is that the Clinton family, that side of the Bill Clinton's family, were very unhappy when this story about Clinton standing up to his stepfather came out. They felt that dirty linen was being washed in public. They didn't appreciate how this story was shared. They felt their entire family was being portrayed as a bunch of rednecks and lowlifes. They understood the political necessity of it, but they were not pleased with it.
What role did Roger Clinton, the stepfather, have in Bill Clinton's interest in music?
I beg your pardon?
What role did his stepfather have in Clinton's interest in music as a boy?
Oh, this is something I had never known, is that he played saxophone.
Mm-hmm.
And this is something you don't hear much about, but he actually did play saxophone. So it's unclear. Bill Clinton doesn't talk about it in his autobiography. It's unclear just how much he heard his stepfather playing the sax. But, of course, Bill Clinton is famous for playing the saxophone. You know, he had a saxophone he gave to a cousin, and the cousin believes it was given to Bill, but it's really uncertain.
I love the story that young Bill Clinton was actually offered a music scholarship to LSU, but told a friend that he didn't want to have to stay up all night and be a musician. And he also recognized that he wasn't good enough to be the best in the world.
Well, the interesting thing is he said he didn't want to keep jazz man's hours, and the countless recipients of 2 a.m. phone calls from Bill Clinton over the years might wonder about that. There's a great story of the former senator from Louisiana, John Breaux, tells this story. He says whenever the phone would ring at his home at 2 o'clock in the morning, his wife would say, either one of our kids has been in a car accident or it's Bill Clinton. And it was always Bill Clinton.
Yeah, he is definitely known by everyone who knows him as someone who sleeps very little, has just energy that is almost inhuman.
Amazing. He's such a phenomenally talented man. This is the thing about Bill Clinton. He's so intelligent, and his facility with people is amazing. I mean, his intelligence, it sometimes leaves your just jaw hanging. There's a very funny and wonderful story in the book that talks about him receiving a briefing on a complex issue of trade with the Japanese. Now, Bill Clinton can receive a complex briefing on policy at the same time that he's reading a newspaper, reading a book, doing a crossword puzzle, and at the end of the briefing, a briefing to which he's given no outward sign of paying the slightest bit of attention, at the end of it, he'll ask the question that shows that not only did he hear every word, but that he understands the subject matter as well as the expert giving the briefing, if not better.
But then as a student at Georgetown, he played up the I'm just a good old Southern boy thing. What advantage would there have been to him to do that?
Well, it was kind of a way of sneaking up on people. It was a way of disarming them. He didn't really let people know that he was so brilliant and so intelligent. People learned that as they got to know him. And, of course, it was something that we saw in his political life, too. I don't think many people would have voted for him in Arkansas or nationally if he said, hello, I'm a Rhodes Scholar. I'm one of the smartest people in the world. Vote for me because I can solve your problems. He emphasized the common touch, and that's something Bill Clinton's always had. And it's always something that I think has puzzled some of his critics. Paul Begala, the political consultant, talks about this. He says there are so many sides to Bill Clinton. Yes, he's a student of the Eastern Academy. He has a very prestigious education in several different places. But he's also the guy, the good old boy, who would go to a truck plant, and joke about having AstroTurf in the back of his El Camino when he was a kid. wink, wink, say no more. He's also the guy who, you know, would love to go to barbecue restaurants and eat with his fingers. And it's all really the same person. And sometimes people can't figure out. They can't understand how they think that something there is phony. But really, they are, I think, all authentic.
Michael Takeiff is my guest. He's an independent scholar and oral historian. His new book is called A Complicated Man, The Life of Bill Clinton as Told by Those who Know Him. Our telephone number is 1-800-933-5372 if you'd like to join the conversation. You can also get to us via email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a multidisciplinary program that allows you the intellectual freedom to design your own master's. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is independent scholar and oral historian Michael Takeith. His new book is called A Complicated Man, The Life of Bill Clinton as Told by Those Who Know Him. Join us by calling 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Michael, we've heard so much about the Rhodes Scholarship. I was really interested to read Robert Reich, who would go on to serve as Clinton's labor secretary for a time and was a Rhodes Scholar at the same time, told you that Clinton didn't necessarily take his time in England as seriously as some of the other students did.
Well, Bill Clinton, really throughout his studies, has never been one to spend hours and hours over his books. This is really one of the things that has, another thing that just bedeviled his critics. Leon Panetta, I was trying to get a handle on why so many people hate Bill Clinton. He's governed essentially from the center. He's got this very pleasing personality. He's one of the most charming people in the world. But there is a group of people that just hates his guts. And what Panetta says is everything seemed to come so easy to him. He's the kind of guy who would never crack a book, would never come to class, and yet somehow he'd always manage to ace the final exam. That's the way people saw him in government, in his official positions, and that, in fact, is the kind of student he was.
And then in law school, he falls in love with this woman that is not the quintessential girlfriend for the quintessential Southern boy, and people are really surprised by the relationship with Hillary Rodham.
He was running for Congress at the time, and he had told everyone about this girlfriend he had, this woman from Chicago he'd met in law school, and she arrived in August. And there are a couple of people in the book, a cousin and of Bill Clinton and a good friend of his, two women, and they saw her walk through the door, and they just thought, this woman is from Mars. You know, she had granny dresses on, she had curly hair, she had big, thick glasses, she didn't wear makeup. One of these women, the friend says, at that time, we all wanted to look like Dolly Parton, and we didn't understand. This is not, you know, as you say, this is not the typical a girl a Southern boy brings home to mother. So there was definitely a period of cultural adjustment.
Were you able to get a handle on what the basis is for their, it's hard to describe the nature of their relationship, but to their attraction for one another?
Right, that's the thing. It is very hard to sort of figure out, isn't it? We all wonder about it. In 1992, when Bill Clinton was running for president just before the New Hampshire primary, he went on 60 Minutes. If people remember, it was about 8 or 9 minutes right after the Super Bowl, and it was to discuss this rumor that had surfaced about him and this lounge singer, Jennifer Flowers, who had alleged this long affair. And at one point, the interviewer, Steve Croft, and he also speaks in the book, Steve Croft said, well, Governor, obviously you two have some sort of arrangement or understanding. And Bill Clinton exploded. He went into one of his purple rages, and he said, arrangement? This isn't an arrangement. This is two people who love each other. Well, I think after the Lewinsky scandal, we can say that there is an arrangement of some kind of understanding. But I will say this. I really do believe that the two of them, each one believes that the other is the most wonderful, charming, intelligent, brilliant, fascinating person in the world. So despite everything and however they've managed to work things out, I really do think there is a strong, loving connection.
I was, of all the things, and it's unfortunate that you can't get beyond the sex thing when you talk about Bill Clinton. There's sort of no way to pull it out completely, and you write about this in the foreword of the book. But there was an Arkansas journalist who really spoke very insightfully about Clinton's tendency to fool around, and that is that he thought the woman has to make the first move, that Clinton won't do anything untoward unless he's given a pretty blatant opening.
Well, this is Gene Lyons who talks about what he says is that his wife is a very good-looking woman. I didn't meet her, but he said his wife and other friends of theirs had been around the Clintons. Some of them had worked for Bill Clinton, and they said they'd never gotten any kind of attention in that manner. So perhaps that's Bill Clinton's M.O. You talk to a lot of people, and they'll say he always had an eye for good-looking women. As far as his sex life goes, I heard an awful lot off the record, but when I would say, well, let's put that on the record, let's turn on the tape recorder, people would say, oh, no. One thing that is interesting, though, this is something another Arkansas journalist says, is that this is Ron Fournier, who was working for the Associated Press in Arkansas. He later followed Bill Clinton to Washington. He says when Bill Clinton started to run for president, his bureau in Little Rock said, well, we've got to start following up on all these rumors. We have to figure them out. We have to pay attention to them. So they would go and they'd track down all these things that they heard. Bill Clinton is over in this hotel with a blonde. He's over there with a brunette. And they tried to track down all these stories of the affairs, and they never could confirm any of them. So it led him to wonder, it leads me to wonder, how much of all the rumors we hear can really be true. We know that some of it is true. I don't think we'll ever know really how much of it.
When the Lewinsky scandal broke, it was surprising even to the close staff on a variety of levels. And I think it was Mike McCurry who says something like, wait, that Monica?
Right, exactly. You know, she'd been around. He said she used to flirt with George Stephanopoulos. He had no idea. The only reason she was even near the Oval Office at that moment when she showed her underwear to Bill Clinton and he responded the way he did was because of the government shutdown, and most government employees were on furlough, but the interns, because they weren't being paid, they were allowed to work, and so they were doing jobs normally done by paid employees. I think the fascinating thing about the Lewinsky scandal is that Bill Clinton really should have known what was going to happen. I mean, first of all, it was really unrealistic to think that a 23-year-old would not tell a single solitary soul that she was having a sexual affair with the President of the United States. But even more than that, he should have known what would have happened had the affair come to light, because people had been out to get him. People had been pursuing him, people in the press and the opposition party, since the beginning of his time on the national stage. There was, during the campaign, Jennifer Flowers. There was his draft history. Once he became president, there were the travel office firings, the suicide of Vince Foster, the Whitewater land deal, FBI files found where they shouldn't have been found, the 1996 re-election campaign finance irregularities. In one after another of these scandals, his opponents had been trying to get him, but they'd never been able to draw blood. So it was as if, through all of this, his opponents in the press and in the opposition party had been firing at him with a wide variety of bullets, but they had all turned out to be blanks. With the Lewinsky scandal, he was saying to them, in effect, sorry to have made you waste your time up till now. Here's a truckload of live ammunition.
You know, Michael, we just did an interview on the show yesterday with Paul Sullivan of the New York Times, who's written this book about people who are clutch performers. And we talked about the fact that there are people who are incredibly skilled at performing under pressure in some elements of their lives and then completely blow the other side. Do you think that's a fair description to apply to Bill Clinton?
I think so. I think Bill Clinton, well, look, Bill Clinton is resilient. I mean, more than anything else you can say about him is that he never gives up. You can never really count him out, and people have tried to count him out many, many times. In 1980, when he was defeated in his first shot at re-election as Arkansas's governor. In 1998, when he gave that disastrous speech at the Democratic Convention nominating Michael Dukakis, people thought they'd never hear from him again. 92, no one thought he'd survive the twin revelations of Jennifer Flowers and the draft before the New Hampshire primary. In 1994, when his party lost in the midterms, nobody expected he would breeze to re-election just 2 years later. 1998, when people thought he would resign within a week once we heard the name Monica Lewinsky. In 2001, when he left office under a cloud because of the Mark Rich pardon. And just 2 years ago, in 2008, when he embarrassed himself, when he demeaned the presidency, and when he did his wife no favors during her campaign for the White House. But now, if you believe a poll that was recently published in the Wall Street Journal, he's the most popular politician in America. He just keeps coming back.
Do you think there was an element of him that was maybe unintentionally sabotaging his wife's presidential aspirations?
That's possible. I think the explanation lies elsewhere. There are a couple of explanations in the book. One thing a couple of people say, John Alter, the Newsweek columnist, mm-hmm. and some other people say that he was just out of practice. He hadn't been involved in a meaningful campaign really since 1996 when he ran for re-election. A lot had changed in 12 years. He didn't really understand the way information travels today. He seemed to have a tin ear. He just wasn't attuned to the new realities. But something Paul Begala said that I also think is interesting is that he was so invested in his wife's campaign. Begala says that in private, Bill Clinton will often respond to criticism of himself by saying, okay, that makes sense. Okay, I see that. He'll see validity. But when the criticism is of his wife, he won't hear of it. He just won't allow any attribute any validity to any criticism of his wife. So I think that was part of it, too. And also, let's remember, here was Barack Obama, this Johnny-come-lately, who was a new rival for the hearts and the minds of the Democratic Party electorate, the people who had previously seen Bill Clinton as their hero. I think he was jealous of the spotlight, of the way it was shifting over to Mr. Obama.
How did Clinton cultivate his really powerful relationship with the African-American community in this country?
This goes back, again, it goes back to Arkansas. People will talk about it. They'll marvel about how comfortable he was with African-Americans. There's a great story from an African-American gentleman who was, his name is Ernest Green. He was one of the Little Rock Nine, one of the original people who integrated Little Rock High School in 1957. And he says he was at an event with Bill Clinton, and Clinton said to him, they sang the what's called the Negro National Anthem, lift every heart and sing. And Clinton said to Ernest Green, he said, you know, I think I'm one of the only white people who knows all three verses. And Green said to him, no, Mr. President, you're one of the only people who know all three verses. And there was a great, there's also, with his appointments in Arkansas, one of his first appointments when he became governor was for the director of finance for the state. It was an African-American man named Malin Martin. And what was interesting, what's remarkable about it, is that he appointed this black man not to a job dealing with social services or something else which we might see as, quote-unquote, more typical or at the time thought more suitable. He appointed this man to run the state's finances, to be in charge of the money. Now, it doesn't seem remarkable today when we see many African-Americans who have positions like that. It certainly was remarkable then. It was a very big statement. And African-Americans in Arkansas, and there are some in the book who talk about this, to them that meant an awful lot.
In 1988, Clinton at least toyed with the idea of running for president, but
yes,
told someone that Chelsea was too young at the time. Did that strike you as a genuine reason why he waited?
Oh, that's a great question, and that's one there's a lot of disagreement on. Again, it's complicated, and you hear different opinions. He was certainly concerned with Chelsea. There's the story of him talking to Chelsea, and they were talking about a vacation, and he said, well, you know, I may be busy, and Chelsea said, well, we'll go on without you. But there are also people who recognize that that may have been an excuse. He was very much aware of what might happen with, you know, aspects of his personal life. Gary Hart had just flamed out over his personal life. This was very fresh. But again, there's something interesting. He's talking to a reporter named Max Brantley, the editor of the Arkansas Times. And there are many Arkansas journalists in the book, and they're some of the best interviews, I think, because they knew Bill Clinton before he was attached to the trappings of the presidency. He's just built to them. But he's talking to Brantley about it, and he says, asks him a question. It's kind of vague. He says, do you think a person's personal past indiscretions would be held against him if he runs? And Brantley was wondering about it, and he wasn't sure what Clinton meant. He thought maybe he meant something about drugs. He didn't know exactly that he was talking about sex. So again, what the idea we have of Bill Clinton's sex life, and that it was common knowledge, and that he was running around and everyone saw it and everyone knew it, it's not entirely true.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Michael Takeiff is my guest. The new book is called A Complicated Man, The Life of Bill Clinton as Told by Those Who Know Him. Let's go to the phones now. We'll speak with Lauren in Plano. Hi, Lauren.
Hey, how are you?
Very well, thanks.
I have kind of a comment about the genius and the sex drive thing. My father is a physicist and is probably one of the most charming, just outwardly socially acceptable men I've ever met. But at the utmost end is a philanderer. And I think that's a lot more common than people may find it to be, that people really are just socially charming and are so intelligent that they can allow their sex lives to sort of fly under the radar and unnoticed.
What about that, Michael?
Well, a man with your father's charm and especially with Bill Clinton's charm, I mean, you can imagine a man this charming just wows everybody, and that includes women. So there's so much that's available to him. Another thing to keep in mind, and Jonathan Alter, the Newsweek columnist, says this in the book, that Bill Clinton came from a family of addicts. His mother gambled. His father drank. His stepfather drank. His brother took drugs. Well, Bill Clinton had sex. I think when he took office, many people thought, well, he'll at least keep his pants zippered up for the duration, he'll at least understand that he has to behave himself, but he couldn't control it.
Talk about the relationship that he had with Newt Gingrich.
Fascinating story that a couple of people, a key aide to Newt Gingrich and also a key aide to Bill Clinton, Mike McCurry, say that they had a lot in common. They actually kind of liked each other. For all the public vituperation and the public bitterness and anger that we heard, they had something in common. They both liked to talk about policy. They both fancied themselves very smart. Gingrich, I believe, is a bright man, but he doesn't have the intellect of Bill Clinton. And, of course, he doesn't have the charm of Bill Clinton. Another thing that's really interesting is that Gingrich's aides were afraid, during this period of negotiation over the budget in 1995, Gingrich's aides were afraid to leave him alone with Bill Clinton because they felt he'd be mesmerized by Bill Clinton. He'd be charmed by the man, and he'd give away the store.
Hmm. And then, obviously, it got very ugly as time went by. Clinton took that personally, no?
Took the
attacks by Newt Gingrich personally.
I don't know if he took the attacks by Gingrich personally so much. I think Bill Clinton has always been able to keep his eye fixed on the project, on the goal in mind. I think during the 95-96 period, it really was one of his most impressive hours politically, and I think he was able to focus on the job, which was to redefine the political debate. If you recall, during the first couple of years, Gingrich and the Republicans had defined Bill Clinton very successfully, you know, as a man outside the mainstream. Well, after that, he wanted to turn the tables, define them as the radicals. He was very successful in doing that.
Michael Takeiff is my guest. He's an independent scholar and oral historian. His book is called A Complicated Man, The Life of Bill Clinton as Told by Those Who Know Him. Join our conversation by calling 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a multidisciplinary program that allows you the intellectual freedom to design your own master's. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is independent scholar and oral historian Michael Takeiff. His new book is called A Complicated Man, The Life of Bill Clinton as Told by Those Who Know Him. Our number is 1-800-933-5372. We'll go back to the phones now, this time speak with Fred in Dallas. Hello, Fred.
Hello.
Hi, Fred.
Oh, let me turn you up a little bit.
Thank you.
Okay, can you hear me?
I can.
Okay. Chris, I want to thank you again. I listen to NPR quite a bit, and the contrast between what Fresh Air can do with an author and what you can do on Think with an author is always amazing to me.
That's very kind of you. Thank you.
Well, the truth. But I'm always conflicted when I deal with the topic of Bill Clinton, because I remember when he flew into Fort Worth Airport, and it was snowing and sleeting, and the man sat there with a hoarse voice and still made a speech and stayed on, and the governor at the time was introducing him, and how I voted for that man. And then this whole Levinsky thing comes up, and I kept thinking, he's just like so many other Southern politicians that we've had, you know, Huey Long and LBJ and Jimmy Carter. There's something about their dark character, is the way he put it in his autobiography, that there's related to this, you know, it's sort of alluded here about the sexual addiction business. It's like when the government shut down, he just simply gets bored and entertains himself with Levinsky. And as a Democrat for so many years, I felt like the man was never living up to the responsibility, and the lack of maturity is so frustrating that I told my wife I wasn't going to support Hillary because I knew that this guy was going to go off and blow her chances at some point.
What do you think about that, Michael?
I think a lot of people are disappointed with Bill Clinton, especially many of the people who voted for him. You know, I think it's funny to talk about a man like Bill Clinton, a man who was president for 8 years, governor for 12 years, as an underachiever. But I think we have to be dissatisfied. We wanted more. He was so talented, so phenomenally intelligent, with such incredible gifts with people. Where's that one signature accomplishment to which we can point and say, here's what this man did on behalf of the citizens of his nation and the world? He tried twice with two grand projects. There was healthcare at the beginning of his administration. At the end, there was the Middle East. Both came close, but didn't happen. So we're left kind of, you know, feeling unsatisfied. And this feeling goes back to Arkansas. An Arkansas journalist named Ernie Dumas, sort of called the dean of the Arkansas political press, I think puts it very well. He said Clinton led us to expect miracles, and all we got was modest good works.
Why do you think Clinton has become more popular in recent years?
Well, I mean, first of all, he's out of office, and
he's
no longer has to make the difficult decisions. But there's also something else. I mean, look, the 90s were the last time, period, in our nation when the country could be said to have worked. The economy was booming. Employment was low. The stock market was sky high. The Cold War had ended. We'd won the Cold War. American troops were not dying on foreign shores. People didn't know the name of Osama bin Laden outside of the Pentagon and the CIA, and even the majestic home run records of people like Sammy Sosa and Mark McGuire hadn't yet been cheapened by our knowledge of the chemicals that were sending those balls over the fence. It was a golden age, I think, compared to what's come since, the years filled with war and fear and hard times. So that's a big part of it. But there's something else that I think goes to the enduring popularity of Bill Clinton, and that's that we see ourselves in him. He's a man whose virtues and flaws, while outsized and exaggerated, are so public that we can kind of understand. We know people who try to do the right thing but sometimes make big mistakes. We know smart people who do stupid things. We know people who overeat when they shouldn't. We know people who give in to sexual urges they know they should resist. We know these things about our friends and our coworkers and our families, and we know them about ourselves. So I think we see ourselves in this man. We see him as really one of the most human beings we know.
You know, I am profoundly curious about the relationship that has developed between him and the first President Bush as they go fly around the world and perform these humanitarian missions. I mean, were you able to get a sense at all of what that relationship is really like behind closed doors?
There's not too much about that, but I think what's interesting is that, you know, with President Bush, there isn't the competition.
Mm-hmm.
He knows President Bush has his side of the constituency, his side of the country, and Bill Clinton has his. You know, they're from two different parties in two different places. So there isn't the need to compete. You contrast that with Bill Clinton's relationship with President Jimmy Carter, another Southern governor who became president. Clinton, of course, is a man who served two terms. Carter was only given one. There's always been a natural jealousy and resentment between the two men. It's a very cold relationship, and you contrast that with Bill Clinton's relationship with the first President Bush, and indeed with the second. It's also a very friendly relationship. The relationship with Carter is a very prickly one.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Joan in Plano. Hi, Joan.
Hi. Hi, how are you?
Great, thank you. Go ahead, please. Joan, are you with us?
Hi, this is Joan Cross.
Hi, Joan. You're on the air if you'd like to talk to us.
Oh, yes. Oh, well, I just wanted to tell you this wonderful story about Bill Clinton. I was always really involved in politics, and I knew I was going to vote for Bill and later. I loved his wife and all that. Well, my husband wasn't very interested in that, and he wasn't for him. But we had to go to this conference in Houston, and where Bill Clinton was speaking. And so I got him to go with me, even though he didn't like to do all that. But we were there, and we were all standing waiting for Bill to come in, and nobody noticed at all that there was a little wire that was strung across the area where he was getting ready to come. And the people started pushing close to that. And we were about, I'd say maybe the fifth row. And there was a little boy there, about 12. And the wire was choking him. I didn't even notice it at all. I was busy watching Clinton come in.
Mm-hmm.
But my husband did, and he immediately was going to move, and then about that time, Clinton comes over. Nobody saw it in his group or anything, and just picked up this little boy. You know, everybody was just, you know,
right. So the president basically
all that.
Found
but
the boy.
His mm-hmm. attention was on this kid, and he lifted him up and held him. I mean, the little boy's face was red. I mean, his parents didn't even notice it either.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing. It sounds like he's someone who was able to give people in a crowd, Michael, what felt like very personal attention.
People throughout his career, people even in big crowds, people one-on-one will talk about how when he talks to you, you're the only person in the room. But even in crowds, there's this wonderful quote from an Arkansan. I can just read a small part of it. And I was trying to get a handle on what it is about Clinton. This is a gentleman who was a lawyer and served in the Arkansas legislature. He says, what is it about Clinton? The answer is real simple. If you put him in War Memorial Stadium, Texas-Arkansas game, assuming it was still played, after 2 minutes, you'd have everyone in the stadium swearing that he or she met with Clinton for a full hour, that Clinton listened to what he or she had to say, and that Clinton convinced those folks that he had learned something from them that would save the world, and he'd never thought of it.
So why do you think that there are people who instantly meet him and just can't stand him? What is it that about those people that he's not able to reach?
Well, as I said, some people see him as having gotten to things too easy. Some people see him as unreliable. They don't know where he's going to come down. And it's interesting, in the book, there's a liberal commentator who basically says he's a fake liberal. He's really a conservative. This is Lawrence O'Donnell of MSNBC. He says Clinton was more conservative than Ronald Reagan.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's a conservative commentator, Republican, who says he's a fake conservative, a fake centrist. He was really a far-left liberal. They really don't know where he's going to come down. And then there's another strain of Clinton hatred. This is represented by Lucianne Goldberg in the book. She, as you may know, she was one of the people, she was really the person who, with Linda Tripp, cooked up that scheme to tape the phone calls with Monica Lewinsky and then to get those tapes to the lawyers involved in the Paula Jones case. And she says she's from the South, and Clinton was like every sleazeball she ever knew. He's the guy when she would be walking down the street, around Main Street on Saturday night, he's the guy who would lean out of the window of his car and bang his hand on the door and say, hey, baby.
So she just had that sense from him that
she had that
known
sense
him
from him. So there are people who just... they don't trust him. And Barney Frank, the congressman from Massachusetts, is really wonderful on this. He talks about the cultural hatred on the right, in the base of the Republican Party, people who wanted to pursue impeachment, even when it was clear that the public as a whole wasn't going along. And he says to them, Bill and Hillary Clinton were wizards who had somehow enchanted America off its moral moorings. These people felt like they'd gone to sleep in a Norman Rockwell painting and had awakened in a Bosch triptych. They didn't just want to impeach Bill Clinton. They wanted to drive a stake through his heart.
Let's go back to the phones now at 800-933-5372. We'll speak with Ken in Plano. Hey, Ken.
Yes, hi. I wonder if you could comment, what happens to one's character, one's personality, when every single word you utter matters? What happened to Clinton? And really, this question could apply to anybody, from Spielberg to... to Alan Greenspan. But specifically, what happened to him? And you can speak about Hillary, too, because she loves the limelight also. Thank you.
Right. Well, Bill Clinton certainly does love the limelight. I mean, he has this great appetite for attention. He has many great appetites. That's another thing about him. And one of them is certainly for attention. And he understands that everything he says will be reported. Although he sometimes, again, during the 2008 campaign, he made some really mistakes on this score. He it's really interesting, during the Pennsylvania primary in 2008, he was on a radio show in Philadelphia, and they asked him about his comments in South Carolina about Jesse Jackson and Barack Obama, and he said, well, those people, Obama the campaign, they played the race card on me. And he went on and on, ranting and raving for, you know, 2 or 3 minutes, and kept saying they played the race card on me. The next day, he was asked on camera, "Mr. President, yesterday you said the Obama campaign played the race card on you." And he said, No, I didn't. You checked the transcript. But, Mr. President, you just said, no, you checked the transcript. You're just trying to make these things up. So even though he's used to the limelight and used to being quoted nonstop, there are times when he seems to forget and he loses control.
Do you have any sense whatsoever about what sort of contact he has these days with the current president?
Well, I think he does have contact, but, you know, a couple of people in the book say that Hillary Clinton, once she was defeated by Barack Obama, very quickly just put on the Obama button and went to work for him and got over the hurt. It took Bill Clinton a much longer time, and I don't think he's really ever gotten over it. I still think there's a coldness there, even though you saw him campaigning and speaking on behalf of President Obama in the recent midterm elections. It still has never gotten quite comfortable. Again, it's that competition factor.
Will history ever allow the stain of the sex scandals to not be the primary thing people think of when they recall the Clinton years? 50 years from now, will that still be what everybody knows about this man?
It's very difficult. This is another point made in the book by Doug Brinkley, the historian people may know. When you ask people, well, what famous words do you remember of John F. Kennedy? Well, they'll say, ask not what your country can do for you, ask what you can do for your country. Ronald Reagan, people will say, Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall. What words do people remember of Bill Clinton's? They remember, and when I do live bookstore presentations, people will say this along with me. They remember, I did not have sexual relations with that woman, Miss Lewinsky. The man was president of the United States. He accomplished many things. He tamed the deficit. He led the country through a period of great prosperity. He put an end to genocide in the Balkans. He negotiated a peace treaty in Northern Ireland. I think that's one of his most important achievements. But for all of it, he's stuck with his image, you know, a sex-crazed dude who loves to party. It's sad, and it's funny, of course. People joke about it on late-night television, but it really is tragic, both for him and for the country.
Did you expect going into this project that you might, in fact, at least in your own mind, settle who Bill Clinton is and what he means to do to a greater extent than you were able to do after talking to all these different people?
I don't know if I went in with that expectation. Once I started talking to people, that expectation went out the window. Mm-hmm. I heard so many different opinions, and so many of them I would listen to, and I'd say, okay, that makes sense. Toward the end of the project, I met with someone who is a prominent speaker in the book. This is someone who played a prominent role in the Clinton administration. All the quotes in the book are on the record except for this one. This person said to me, now that you're done, what do you think of Bill Clinton? I said, you know, I'm not sure. This person said to me, yeah, me neither.
Michael Takeoff is an independent scholar and oral historian. The new book is called A Complicated Man, The Life of Bill Clinton as Told by Those Who Know Him. Michael, fascinating piece of work. Thank you so much for spending the hour with us.
Thank you.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.
Think production team includes associate producer Betsy Lewis, an engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.